Howdy. Welcome to our program. I'm Casey Gobe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. Our first article will be from our September issue, and we're going to open with the state. This is the culture. Our column this month is by Kiana Fitzgerald. It's entitled, Handed Cameras. Student leaders at UT and A&M document what it means to be black at a predominantly white Texas university. I've always loved my hands. In their deftness, flexibility, and deep brown color, they represent my strength and totality. My freshman year of college, though, my love for them wavered. One afternoon in 2007, as I chowed down in a dining hall at Texas State University, a white student sitting at my table, Lauren, glanced over at me. Her eyes scanned their way up and down my body, finally settling on my hands. Monkey paws, she yelled out, laughing hysterically. My mouth dropped open. Her words stung more than any insult that had been hurled at me over the years. Until then, I had considered her a friend. I took the time to patiently educate her, to tell her that her comment was racist. She replied simply that she didn't know. She'd grown up in Austin, a segregated city that is often touted for its progressive politics. Lauren didn't have much experience being around black people and no idea how to properly communicate with me, with us. She and I drifted apart after that exchange, one of many microaggressions I experienced during my 4 years as an undergraduate at Texas State. By then, I'd resorted to mental gymnastics as a means of persevering despite enduring a lifetime of attacks on my identity. When I was growing up in Seguin, fellow classmates had grabbed and petted my natural hair without my permission, and I was used to being teased and called KKKiana. But instead of seeing these negative experiences for what they were, I flipped them into relationship-building exercises. These moments became the foundation of many of my friendships. Nevertheless, I had to constantly think about how to navigate white spaces at Texas State. I struggled to get through some days without breaking down. As a black student attending a predominantly white institution, I frequently grappled with finding my own path. At Texas State, whose student body was just 10.8% black as of fall 2019, a huge fixture of campus life involved rushing a sorority or fraternity, most of which were traditionally white. Meanwhile, I sought community in the Bobcat basketball band, the Phi Eta Sigma National Honor Society, and the Red Cross Club. I found out about campus groups for black students later in my collegiate career, but at that point, joining one felt like attempting to insert myself into an already solidified family. I don't regret attending a largely white school, and I learned a lot about how to handle those sorts of situations. Still, I often wish I had been encouraged to see the beauty in my blackness back then, and that I had more opportunity to carve out true spaces to build community with others who, like me, felt isolated. Two recent graduates of the state's largest schools, University of Texas at Austin, 4.9% black, and Texas A&M, 3.3%, created initiatives that will go a long way in providing these kinds of opportunities. Adrant Kadhafi-Barial, a 2020 UT design graduate, created and photographed a visual project named The Black Yearbook as a response to the dearth of black students at the university. And at A&M, Adaizi Omakam, who graduated in May with the BA in Public Health, founded the Black Student Yearbook to, as the organization's mission states, act as a reminder that they too helped A&M become a better place. Barial announced his project in April 2019, and Omakam, independently of Barial, came up with the A&M Yearbook that summer. When I first saw images of Barial's project, I was struck by his photo of a small sea of UT students at Black Homecoming wearing burnt orange, revelrous students of every gender being photographed without any athletic context. Other students had been photographed alone in contemplative moments. Some wore UT memorabilia, while others donned black cultural staples such as a do-rag. In A&M's yearbook, hard copies of which were shipped starting in the spring of 2021, I saw ebullient black students joined at the hip and smiling together. Studying both of these distinctive projects, I felt the students' happiness and camaraderie, as well as their stark solemnity. Many of us are quarantined and apart from our loved ones and communities, these images feel especially poignant. There's an immediacy to these projects, too, as students at both schools contend with addressing anti-black racism, both past and present, on their own campuses amid the global uprisings galvanized by the Black Lives Matter movement. Ultimately, these ventures embody something I long wished for while studying at Texas State, a community of color connected through creativity. I think this will show black students that you're free to be who you want in these spaces, Berryall says of the Black Yearbook. You don't need to contort yourself or change in order to fit in better. You can just exist. A little sidebar here, red tape. Marion Ford, a black student, was accepted to UT in 1954 after Brown versus Board of Education. His acceptance was rescinded, however, after he said he wanted to play football. Now, text. In 1964, University of Texas Board of Regents formally ended segregation in the last place where it was practiced on campus, its dorms, a full decade after Brown v. Board of Education required educational institutions to integrate their classrooms. A pleasant day, black Longhorns don't have to look too far to see that injustice remain on campus. That's what drove a group of student athletes to write an open letter to administrators in June about aspects of campus life that bear troubling origins, such as the school song, The Eyes of Texas, which has its roots in a campus minstrel show that ran every year well into the 1960s. Those ubiquitous reminders of exclusion, coupled with the scarcity of black students, create an environment where those students say they haven't always felt welcome or visible. That was the first thing that was really alarming to me when the excitement died down and I started looking around, Berryall says of his early days at UT. Like, oh, there's somebody here that looked like me. Or they are there, but there aren't very many of them. When Berryall learned that black men make up a mere 1.7% of students attending UT, he began conceptualizing a project that would capture the reality of their experiences at the university. Over a year and a half, Berryall interviewed black male students and documented them in spontaneous moments. In the spring of 2019, Berryall exhibited his photo project titled 1.7, at East Austin's George Washington Carver Museum. As an extension of 1.7, the Black Yearbook, a project that Berryall crowdfunded online, widens his focus to include black UT students of every gender. Hypatia Sarunke, a 2020 graduate with a double major in Plan 2 Honors and African Diaspora Studies, is a friend of Berryall's who is featured as a subject in the series. Sarunke says that during her time at UT, she knew a fair number of black students who suffered from imposter syndrome, including herself. Becoming a member of the Epsilon Beta chapter of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated, helped her feel more at home as a member of Black UT, as did projects like the Black Yearbook. Being a black woman at UT was just so complex of an experience, she says, and I don't think I've fully grasped what that has done to help me develop and also harm my development. Berryall hopes the Black Yearbook, funding for which past his initial GoFundMe goal of $20,000, will shed light on the work the university needs to do to educate students, faculty, and alumni. I really just want to give black students an opportunity to showcase what the experience is like, good or bad, or anything in between that, he says. What I think this project does really successfully is that it allows for introspective conversations to happen, as well as these external ones too, where we hold up the lens to the university, we also held up a mirror to ourselves. Omakam, the founder of A&M's Black Student Yearbook, had an unexpected experience with racial dynamics when she first arrived at College Station in fall 2019. I didn't really know about the ratio of black to white students until I got there and experienced it, she says. I went to a predominantly white high school. Then when I got to A&M, I decided I want black friends. I want African friends because I'm Nigerian, so I wanted to meet people I could relate to more. Once Omakam started going to black events and hearing people's stories at A&M, she says, it became more evident how oppressed we are on campus. Last summer, Omakam was hanging out with friends, all of whom had been involved with yearbook production before college, when the idea for a physical yearbook centering on A&M's black students came to her. We were all talking about high school and how we all had yearbooks, she said. I was just thinking, what if we did a black student yearbook? Omakam researched how to start an organization, got it approved by A&M's administration, and started a Twitter account, which helped drum up interest in the yearbook over the 2019-2020 school year. Omakam then selected images submitted by campus groups and student photographers. Ivielle Edgerson, a senior majoring in university studies, a track within the educational psychology program with a concentration in child professional services, and the current president of A&M's Black Student Yearbook, is forging ahead with the project now that Omakam has graduated. Though Edgerson says the pandemic has made logistical steps more difficult, such as taking photos of students, The group of eight and counting continues to hold Zoom meetings and plan for the year ahead. It feels amazing, just because with everything going on, it's hard to feel as if you're making a difference, Edgerton says, letting them know, like, hey, we're also here doing our part. We matter just as much as anyone else matters. The world needs this, Boreal says of his project. These narratives are more important now than ever. I think there's a window of opportunity for people to really take this in. The Black Yearbook is currently being turned into a short video available online, a physical book, and an in-person exhibition to be shown whenever it's safe to open art galleries again. He hopes the project will live on at his alma mater, perhaps in a different form than he initially imagined. There are some very talented people that, if using their platform and their medium in a particular way, that can do the exact same thing, he says. I wonder what it looks like under a different name, under a different approach, under a different artist, a different lens. Watching my hands fly across my laptop's keyboard while writing this, I couldn't help reflecting on late nights I spent in college typing out research papers and newspaper articles. I'm left wondering how useful they would have been to a project like Boreal's or OmaCam's, and what kind of community I might have built at Texas State if something like either of these projects had existed when I was a student. These initiatives, which will always belong to the Black consciousness of A&M and UT, are renderings of what is possible when you love and live your Blackness from head to toe, from overflowing heart to dexterous finger. Kiana Fitzgerald is a music journalist, cultural critic, and DJ. Her work has appeared in Rolling Stone, NPR, Vibe magazine, Paper magazine, Billboard, and other publications. Next up, one of our feature articles in this month's edition. This is entitled Flight Risk. It's by Katie Vine. Theodore Robert Wright III destroyed cars, yachts, and planes in one of the boldest insurance fraud schemes Texas has ever seen. That was only the half of it. When federal agent Jim Reed drove into a small airport in the East Texas city of Athens mid-morning on September 15, 2014, he was expecting to find a straightforward case of arson, an easy case for the new guy. He introduced himself to the Athens Jet Center's co-owners, two brothers in their 70s named Wayne and Galen Adkinson, who led Reed to a small jet, a 1971 Cessna 500 Citation One that looked like it had been barbecued on a rotisserie. It was burned in half, Wayne Adkinson recalled. The nose tipped on the ground, and the back half was on the ground, too. For 2 weeks, the Citation had just been sitting on the tarmac at Athens Municipal Airport next to the jet center, they told Reed. But 2 days before Reed's visit, they'd come into work after receiving a call. The plane was in flames. Reed, a fit 29-year-old who was as careful with his clean-cut brown hair and clean-shaven face as he was with his deposition-ready phrasing, was only 6 months into his job as an agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Reed didn't doubt that the fire was a result of arson. Mechanical failure on an inactive Citation was about as unlikely as a lightning strike. As one pilot would later say, planes don't just catch fire in a hangar. They don't spontaneously combust. Driving out from Tyler, where he was based, Reed considered the typical arsonist who might be involved. Was this a teen vandal, local troublemaker? Later, when he reviewed the airport's surveillance footage, he could see a shadow of a man thrown from the flame in a ball of fire when it exploded. He checked the area burn centers, hospitals, and morgues. Nobody had turned up with burns. Whoever set fire to the plane had somehow walked away in one piece. The Adkinsons told Reed that a pilot had flown a small plane, a Beechcraft Bonanza, in and out 2 weeks earlier on August 29th, just landed, and then quickly took off. That alone seemed strange, the brothers agreed. Rare is a pilot who flies into a small airport just to admire the layout. A couple days after that, the Bonanza showed up in Athens again, and this time, one of the airfield's early risers, a pilot named Carol Dyson, spotted its 30-something dark-haired pilot slinking around the not-yet-toasted Citation. Innocently, Dyson initiated some small talk, and the pilot told him the Bonanza's alternator and battery were having issues. Plane won't start, the pilot said. Insistent on helping, Dyson looked at the battery, and then the pilot hopped in and turned the key. Plane started right up. Well, it's running now, Dyson said. Pilot thanked him and took off. In a small airport like the one in Athens, planes might come and go unannounced, but Dyson, who owned an aircraft servicing business at the airport, was diligent about writing down tail numbers. Now Reed took note of the number Dyson gave him for the suspicious Bonanza, N273. Thanking everybody. anybody. Reed excused himself and called a worker at the Federal Aviation Administration, who told him that the Bonanza was in the process of being registered. Paperwork was so fresh, in fact, that it was sitting right there on his fax machine. The FAA representative shared the plane's recent history with Reed. The Bonanza had been purchased in 2013 by Raymond Fosdick, whom Reed would later identify as the dark-haired pilot Dyson had spotted prowling around the airfield. Reed also learned the name of the owner of the burned Citation, Theodore Robert Wright III, TR for short. He was a businessman with an address in the coastal town of Kima, southeast of Houston. Using his phone, Reed Googled the two men's names together. Within seconds, he realized the duo was internet famous. He scrolled down and read the stories about a disastrous journey TR and Fosdick had taken 2 years earlier in September of 2012. In what seemed to be a typical flight, the two left Baytown near Houston, bound for Sarasota, Florida. Halfway there, 11,000 feet in the air, they noticed that their plane, a Beechcraft Baron, had caught fire. They used textbook procedures to carry out an emergency landing in the Gulf of Mexico, ditching the plane 30 miles from shore. Then they waded in the water, where sharks and Portuguese man-o-wars, which sting like jellyfish, had been spotted to be rescued. While they floated, TR documented their bobbing heads and their subsequent rescue by the Coast Guard on an iPad in a waterproof case. Wearing aviator sunglasses and a lightweight sun hat, TR looked straight into the iPad's camera. His partner, Fosdick, was shyer. He smiled in the background with the obligation of a teen whose mom was asking him to pose nicely for a photo. "There's Raymond," TR said shortly after the ditching. "We seem to be okay without injuries." TR seemed only slightly out of breath as he navigated the waves on a flotation device. "I believe we've been in the water for about an hour now," he said. "No sign of any rescue or emergency services yet." As daylight dwindled, the two men treaded water for 3 hours until the Coast Guard spotted and rescued them. Reed also found a clip of the two on NBC's Today show, one of the many media outlets that shared their story. He pressed play and studied TR and Fosdick as they narrated their misadventure to awestruck host David Gregory. TR, the better dressed of the two guests, had a lantern jaw, short cropped hair, and rectangular glasses, and he sat on the set's beige couch with his left ankle crossed over his right knee. Radiated confidence, intelligence, and ease as he told the tale. "People ask us, were you worried?" "Well, we weren't worried at all," TR said. Fosdick looked weary with his left arm in a sling, yet he attempted the same bluster. Fear did enter his mind, he admitted with a submissive smile. "However, because of experience, because we've both been in stressful situations, we remained calm." Agent Reed didn't know what to make of Fosdick and TR. First, these two guys crashed into the Gulf of Mexico together. Then each flies into this tiny airport within days of each other, and 2 weeks later, TR's jet bursts into flames. The more Reed dug, the more certain he became that the Citation fire was just one piece of a grand scheme. TR, who is now 35, had always sought adventure. When he was 9 years old, he pushed a little sunfish sailboat into Lake Champlain in upstate New York and tried to sail the 10 miles to Burlington, Vermont, much to his parents' consternation. But as an adult, he found it was business deals that gave him a rush. He liked the competition, the stakes, and the thrill of achievement, and he loved to stir up drama. He was always looking for something that had a story, one of his associates told him. Sometimes he found things that had a story, and sometimes he kind of created the story himself. He used to be just Ted Wright. Back in Port Kent, New York, the 15-block hamlet where he grew up, his neighbors would have bristled at calling him Theodore. In a town where most people worked at the local prison or the nearby Bombardier rail car manufacturing facility, using a formal name like that would have implied he felt like he was better than they were. Though, he did. While other kids wore steel-toed boots and t-shirts advertising car parts, he wore a suit and carried a briefcase. "I didn't own my first pair of jeans until I was like 20 years old," he said. He was already dressing for the job he wanted, high-stakes player. Even as a kid, he was eager to leave Port Kent. "I had to get out of there," TR told me. "Port Kent is an hour south of Montreal, one of the greatest cities in North America, and it's 5 hours from New York City, and no one in Port Kent had been to either of those places." His parents owned a junk shop and then a Tex-Mex restaurant, which in upstate New York might as well have been food from Mars, he said. Securing his family a middle-class living, But during the mid to late 90s, when he was in middle school, the area fell into a recession and his family slipped into poverty. The Wrights moved into a small rental house. High school, T.R. began skipping class and playing pranks, once covering a teacher's car with AOL CD-ROMs, another time dumping out a teacher's Diet Coke and replacing it with regular Coke just to mess with him. A friend whom T.R. met later in life remembered discussing with T.R. a realization they'd both come to when they were young, that the rules of business were man-made and thus perhaps fungible. I mean, he has always been an arrogant prick, a childhood friend said without affectation. We felt we were smarter than most people. I wouldn't call that a negative thing. I would call that identifying the market. TR's confidence helped him build a lucrative career at a very early age. According to TR, it began like this. At 16, he worked at a kiosk in the local mall selling cell phone accessories. But around 2 years later, when the kiosk's parent company went under, his boss told him that as his last payment, he could have all the remaining inventory, signs, and displays from two kiosks, the value of which he estimates at $80,000. He sold that inventory and some additional merchandise and invested the proceeds in setting up more kiosks. By his 19th birthday, he said, he had $4.5 million, of which he invested in a kiosk company he called Wright Marketing Group, spread over 40 locations. Eventually broadened sales to novelties and games, all kinds of stupid gifts with a 2,000% markup. The venture escalated on a kiosk buying trip to the Shenzhen International Toy and Education Fair in China, where, TR claimed, he came up with an idea for a console for pirated video games called Power Player that would plug into a TV and allow users to play classics like Space Invaders and Galaga. He decided to focus on selling Power Player wholesale. It was a huge hit, TR said, until the FBI began arresting the biggest Power Player retail operators. Panicking, he abandoned his business and left the United States with $8,000 to travel in Europe. This rags-to-riches origin story contains all the elements of a typical T.R. Wright anecdote. Big money in the balance, risks taken, legal minefields skirted, laced with difficult to fact-check details. It was easy to believe, for example, that as a teenager he hooked up with a girl about his age while he was on vacation with her and her family. It wasn't as easy to believe that he then hooked up with the girl's 35-year-old mother. The girl hated my guts. I mean, I'm sleeping with her mother. That the girl's father caught TR and her mother in the act and drove him to the airport in an excruciating 2-hour-long journey. His associate said he wasn't always sure which stories were true and which were lies, but they were always entertaining. Though a handful of people were arrested for selling Power Player in 2005, TR's name appears nowhere in the news articles about the investigation. TR's family and purported Power Player associates didn't return phone calls for this article, and the man TR said was his lawyer in the Power Player case has died. A close high school friend who worked in the cell phone kiosk with TR remembers that his kiosk business did well. Whether it made him a millionaire, he could not say, and said he does remember TR importing Power Player. TR said he did not face legal trouble and that after the Power Player raids, he laid low in Europe for 5 months. When he returned home to the United States, he bought a junkyard in upstate New York and began selling car parts on a website. Online sales were unheard of in the junkyard business, he said. Next thing he knew, he was getting calls from all over the country for specific model seatbelts and other useful scrap. TR said he wasn't sure how much money he'd amassed by the time he hit the legal drinking age. Money for me, it came and went. I never said, I've got this much money. I'm out doing things that I find exciting and that I'm passionate about and I want to do, and the money just ebbs and flows, you know? But it must have flowed a little more than it ebbed, because by his late 20s, TR had enough money to purchase a 110-foot yacht. He named it Never Enough. The boat slept 12 people in a master cabin, a VIP cabin, a guest cabin, and cruise quarters. He later extended the yacht's helipad. He docked the yacht in Kima and rented a home attached to a hangar at the Baytown Airport and a Spartan guest house in Kima. He continued spending his money on expensive toys. Besides boats, there were watches, cars, and eventually planes. The older crowd at the hangars TR visited in Baytown and Galveston remembered that he was a novice pilot when they first met him, but that he quickly became adept at flying small planes, big jets, helicopters, and experimental aircraft. In short order, he could even fly a gyrocopter and a hot air balloon. He was a natural at flying, said pilot Barry Larson. No one, though, described TR as cautious. Pilot and aircraft mechanic George Gould, who has his own hangar at Shoals International Airport in Galveston, remembers TR as someone who liked to kick the tires and light the fires, sometimes ignoring pre-flight inspections when he was in a hurry. You've got to be real deliberate in what you're doing. Some people just that don't soak in, Gould said with a laugh. Old TR had an adventurous personality. TR's acquaintances knew him as a hotshot in flip-flops and shorts who cruised around Kima in Ferraris, Lamborghinis, and Porsches, pulling up to small airports to check in on his latest acquisitions. He had a different girl on his arm every time, I'll tell you, another airplane mechanic and pilot named Bill Brown said, impressed by TR's company. I might be old, but my eyes still work. Besides women, TR was usually accompanied by his friend, Shane Gordon. Gordon was a lawyer, 14 years older than TR, a normal dude with a normal wife and three kids, according to one acquaintance. By then, TR had also begun spending time with Raymond Fosdick, who was then in his mid-30s. The two met when the captain of Never Enough hired Fosdick to help pump sewage out of the yacht. TR recalled that Fosdick ended up spraying raw sewage all over himself. He's like Kramer, TR said. He is this endearing idiot that I don't want to call a friend. He's just there. He's like that family member some people have. You just can't get rid of him. Fosdick declined to be interviewed for the story. TR set up corporations with generic names like Theodore R. Wright Enterprises and Government Auctions Online, as well as companies with less discreet names like Sly International Holdings and Carissus, Latin for cunning. TR was living the dream, but he was also restless. 2012, a year after purchasing the yacht, he bought a training jet for fighter pilots that required MiG parts from overseas. He said he called up a former Soviet test pilot who found the required parts on a former Cold War base in Hungary. The pilot TR named, contacted in Los Angeles, says he doesn't remember this incident, suggested someone else assisted TR, and added that the parts likely came from Bulgaria. There's a guy smoking a cigarette, said TR, the purchase overseas, and he comes in real shady. You hand him your briefcase full of cash, and you hope to God that 6 weeks later your containers and MiG parts arrive in California, which they did. So now I have, by my math, 200 years worth of parts for my L-39. Well, what am I going to do with that? I'm going to do the same thing I did with my junkyard business in 2005. I started putting them online. After that, TR said, is when his business took an unexpected turn. The MiG parts gave TR the calling card he needed to gain a foothold in a high-stakes international game. He learned that countries, just like individuals, look for deals when buying the parts required to maintain their archaic fleets. I became known as a guy who could deliver anything anywhere in the world, he said. If someone required plane parts, he was their guy. Occasionally, he sold entire aircraft. Sometimes the planes and helicopters he delivered were demilitarized, with weapons removed, he said. Other times, they weren't. He never planned to become an international arms dealer, he said. Sales just snowballed. The deals get bigger and the stakes get higher, he said, and before you realize it, you got a load of freshly overhauled attack helicopters getting snuck out of Marseille in the middle of the night going to Chad. As always, TR enjoyed relaying eyebrow-raising tales of his professional exploits to select friends. Socially, he was elevating his game, too. I never had so much fun with anybody I barely knew, said one ex-girlfriend, a Swedish pilot whom I reached in Belgium. He could suggest something like, can we go to Iceland? Or, do you want to join me in the Bahamas on Monday? I have to fly this private jet. Would you care to join? You know, he's so impulsive. He seemed incapable of banality. A woman who once went out on a date with him to Houston said, he picked me up in a limo on her date to the freaking piano bar. Once, when TR suspected a minor celebrity he was seeing had intentionally given him food poisoning through a homemade brownie, he told a friend he was attempting to break out of her mansion's locked gate. Why are you doing this? The friend recalled asking him. You know, TR responded, worst case, it'll make a good chapter in my book. TR often posted selfies on social media, showing him in exotic or daring situations, squinting into the distance with a giant gun in his hands. In the pictures, he looks relaxed and aristocratic, like a model for upscale watches. To burnish his image as a James Bond-type character, he once posted a photo of himself flying a jet while wearing a tuxedo. In one photo, he appeared to be flying with the rapper Waka Flocka Flame. TR paraded the life he'd achieved. He hated being called lucky, said the woman who went on one date with TR. He would say, this has nothing to do with luck. a little late for the actual middle of the program. Right here, we're going to take a natural break and remind you that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on site and sound broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight Into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight Into Sound, broadcasting since 1967. Back to our text. In 2014, after returning from the arson investigation visit in Athens, Jim Reed sat in his fluorescent-lit government office cubicle in Tyler and started building a file with a typewritten tab, Athens Jetfire. The case became almost like a hobby, something Reed would pursue when he wasn't chasing down the Aryan Brotherhood or street gang members. He began calling the Texas Department of Insurance and the National Insurance Crime Bureau and studying TR's financial records. A year later, a picture had emerged. Reed believed he had found two clear cases of fraud. In March 2012, TR bought a 1966 Beechcraft Baron, the plane that later ended up in the Gulf of Mexico, for $46,000, then insured it for $85,000. Not unusual for companies to insure aircraft for greater sums than they were bought for. Values vary greatly by make and model. After attending training that included water landing instruction, TR departed the Baytown Airport with Fosdick. Then the alleged mechanical failure occurred, and the pair ditched the plane in the Gulf of Mexico. TR got the insurance money, but that wasn't all. Reed found that the two also conspired in a personal injury lawsuit. Fosdick sued TR and received a $100,000 settlement from TR's insurance company, then turned around and transferred $42,000 to TR's company, Carissus. Then, in March 2014, TR bought the doomed Citation for $190,000. One of his companies, Plaisir en Vol, or Fun in Flight, co-owned with a Frenchman named Philippe Ardouin, had secured insurance on the plane for $440,000. That fall, after the fire, Plaisir en Vol filed the insurance claims and TR received the proceeds. Reed noted that TR used the money to buy a Learjet, previously owned by tabloid talk show host Jerry Springer. As records from banking and telephone companies arrived, Reed uncovered even more instances of what he believed to be criminal activity. He learned that in March 2014, TR crashed his Lamborghini, which he had bought for $76,000, into a water-filled ditch. His insurance company gave him $169,554. In October 2014, TR bought a 1998 Hunter Passage sailboat in Hawaii for $50,150. He sold it a month later to a man in Honolulu named Edward DeLima for $193,500, money TR loaned DeLima through a mortgage company he and his business partners created. The boat sank in a marina under mysterious circumstances. In 2015, DeLima, who had insured the Hunter Passage for an increased value, handed over the $180,023.80 insurance payout to his mortgage company, held in the name of T.R. Wright. By April 2016, Reed had followed the paper trail as far as he could. It was time to start interviewing co-conspirators. Deciding whom to approach first, he knew he had to choose someone who knew enough to give credible, useful information, but who didn't have such loyalty to TR that he'd turn around and scare all the other co-conspirators out of the country. He decided to start with Edward DeLima, having surmised that he and TR were not close friends. Reed flew to Honolulu and, along with the local agent, visited DeLima, a 225-pound registered sex offender with a gray beard that grew down to his collarbone, at his workplace. After Reed invited him into the agent's car, DeLima listened to him for a while, taking in the information, sweating a little. Reed mentioned the insurance deposits to TR and brought up DeLima's thin history with boats. DeLima eventually told Reed everything, how TR had asked him to pretend to own the boat, how TR had promised him big bucks but ultimately gave him a few $1,000s. It was useful information, and it was enough to write an indictment, but it wasn't enough for Reed to indict TR for what he felt was certain was a much larger tangle of scams. Then, as Reed was coming to Raymond Fosdick's Facebook profile, he noticed photographs of Fosdick with a firearm, something Fosdick, who was a convicted felon, wasn't allowed to have in his possession. Using that as leverage, Reed visited Fosdick at his high-end apartment complex in uptown Houston. Reed's surprise, Fosdick, like DeLima, told him everything. He even handed over emails and iMessages between him and TR. In the iMessages, the men discussed the Athens fire scheme in play-by-play detail. Expletive, have your story straight and don't expletive around, TR messaged Fosdick. As evidence mounted, Reed began chatting with a few pilots in the Kima area under the guise of completing a standard insurance inquiry about the Cetacean fire. He found that even locals who liked TR suspected he was up to something fishy. Many said they'd been wondering when someone was going to come poking around. A few loyally told Reed they didn't know anything. Hey, one old-timer told TR later, there was some insurance guys coming around and asking about you. TR just laughed it off. The case had come to remind Reed of the saying, perception becomes reality. It seemed to him that Ted Wright had almost willed his character of TR Wright into existence. From the time he was a school kid wearing a suit, he was determined to become a larger-than-life persona, projecting the confident James Bond image in the stories he told his friends and later in his social media feeds, even when he might have been struggling financially. By the end of the period under investigation, Reed said, TR was pretty close to everything he was representing himself to be. TR might have continued his bachelor lifestyle indefinitely if not for a California attorney named Ashley Polston, whom he met over email while making a speculative real estate deal in 2014. Polston did not return calls requesting an interview. Curious to see what she looked like, he found her on Instagram. I just saw her and thought, wow, he said, I couldn't imagine a more beautiful woman. He emailed her and wrote that he would love to pick her up, fly her to Las Vegas for the weekend. Soon, they were rarely apart. It was a fairy tale relationship, TR said. We never had an argument. One day, when he was in the midst of negotiating a stressful transaction, TR flew Polston out to a barrier island in the Mediterranean at sunset and proposed to her. I definitely became a one-woman man, he said. That was a big change. It was life-changing. I suppose I matured overnight. He originally planned to marry at the renowned Ice Hotel in Sweden, but because of an unusually warm winter, they held a small, unofficial ceremony in the south of France. TR said they didn't want to wait to start a family, and in August 2015, they had a baby girl. The family bounced between Las Vegas and Canada, between Europe and the yacht. TR decided to rename the Never Enough after his daughter. TR pared down his Facebook and Instagram usage, but the few posts he shared showed a far-flung surroundings. The trio posing in front of the Dead Sea, wandering the streets of Aix-en-Provence in southern France, flying en route to some other destination. Sometimes they almost seem like a normal family, albeit one prone to excess. Once TR flew Barbara Carlton, who had been his wife's birth doula, in a Czech L-39 jet and turned the plane upside down. We went 4 or 5 G's, which was plenty, Carlton said. Aaron Pierce, who was captain of TR's yacht, remembers TR telling him, "Your captain, point us in a direction." Pierce would take the family along the coastline from Tampa, Florida to Lake Charles, Louisiana, cruising at a leisurely 10 knots. When they'd pull up to an island, Polston would take their daughter out to play. They went up to the beach, spent the day, came back sunburned, Pierce said. It was just a good family. These were some of the best years of TR's life. Sure, he still thought fondly of his early pursuits of women and aerial stunts, but he was finally beginning to feel a more lasting sense of satisfaction, which isn't to say that he abandoned thrill-seeking completely. At one point, TR flew a 737 he bought, a mobile command center, into a desert base in Israel, where civilian planes rarely go. I land and I've got with me my wife and a baby, who is in a baby burn under my suit jacket. I get out of the airplane into the Israeli desert, and I start walking the F-16s to pick out which blocks I'm going to buy, he said. The Israelis, he added, looked at him with his wife and daughter in tow in disbelief. Though photography was forbidden at the base, Colston snapped pictures of their daughter playing with rocks as rows of surplus F-16s and Mirages sat in the background. I got to the point where I was probably too arrogant and cocky for my own good, TR said. I thought that I would never be arrested or that I could buy my way out of it. That's how things work in the rest of the world. By the summer of 2017, Jim Reed had been piecing together information about TR for 3 years. He practically memorized the web chart he'd taped to the wall to map out TR's schemes. Reed felt a strong sense of urgency. Here, he thought, is a guy who can drive or fly just about any vehicle with ties to foreign governments, who's known to use satellite phones and pay in cash, and who deals with foreign corporations that would give him funding outside U.S. jurisdiction. He wanted to get PR into custody before he fled the country, never to be seen again. The problem was finding him. He couldn't connect TR's name to any U.S. properties. Then, late in June, Reed was checking email on his phone when he got a location alert. A cell phone record showed TR in Las Vegas. Reed called the U.S. Marshals Service in Nevada and boarded a plane the next day, expecting to spend a day or two preparing a plan for the arrest. Instead, when he walked into the Las Vegas ATF office, local agents and marshals were waiting for him, and one asked if he was ready to pick up TR right then. "We're going to go get this guy," one said. No one, not Reed or any of the marshals and agents, was going to take any chances that TR would get away. They drove directly to Trump International Hotel in Las Vegas, where Reed knew TR stayed from time to time, and convened with other marshals and agents who'd arrived earlier in the lobby. The group had set up a sting beyond anything Reed had ever seen in person, like a scene out of a 70s action film. Almost a dozen agents dressed to blend in were stationed inside and outside the hotel. While Reed does not remember every disguise, TR swears they included a janitor with a push broom, a gardener, a tourist with a camera, a man dressed in a full cowboy outfit, and one guy dressed like the Indian from Village People. Reed waited in the bustling hotel lobby with his giant crystal chandelier, trying to decide whether he should stay put or ask management to tell him which room TR was in. 59 floors up, TR was about to close a deal based in Israel on which he'd stake 95% of his net worth. "We were in the 11th hour, about to get paid," TR said. He was also juggling unrelated business. He had to deliver a bribe for an official of a foreign government. He placed $70,000 in cash into a Louis Vuitton briefcase, along with the title for a Ferrari, two pistols — he often carried at least one firearm — and two cell phones, one of them disposable, and took the gilded elevator down. Reed, still waiting in the lobby, recognized TR from the photos he'd been collecting over the years, and his adrenaline shot up. TR strode across the white marble floor and out the door. Reed followed him outside as TR took his keys from the valet and stepped toward his car, a Ferrari. In an instant, it seemed like the entire hotel, from the janitor to the garden, turned toward TR. "TR, right," Reed said. "We have a federal arrest warrant." TR turned and froze, shocked. "What's going on?" he asked as agents surrounded him. When Reed took TR's briefcase and opened it, contents were almost laughably cliche, like a Jason Bourne starter kit. TR claimed that he was just going out to run some errands, an answer that didn't satisfy anybody. As TR sat in a temporary holding cell that night, Reed thought that the evidence of insurance fraud was overwhelming enough that TR would be held without bond. "This guy met every standard for federal detention," he said. The next day, in federal court in Las Vegas, Reed took his seat and watched as TR marched into court with his high-paid lawyer, Gabriel Grasso, who was one of the lawyers who represented O.J. Simpson in Simpson's infamous 2007 sports memorabilia robbery attempt. He listened as Grasso argued that TR Wright was a law-abiding businessman who deserved some time to get his affairs in order. The judge refused to hear any argument to the contrary. Reed never even took the stand. As the judge granted TR a conditional release, he'd have to pay $150,000, hand over his pilot's license and passport, and wear an ankle monitor. Reed sat in despair. He was sure he'd never see TR again. Though Reed had heard that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Tyler was working around the clock and filing motions to set a hearing as soon as possible, he was still shocked when TR walked into the federal courthouse in Beaumont with his family 10 days later. Typically, detention hearings are a simple affair, running 20 minutes or so. This one was hours long, filled with bombshell details. When Reed took the stand, he argued that TR was dangerous. He was, Reed said, a person who had worked with the Zetas, a notoriously violent Mexican cartel. This was an overblown accusation, TR told me, since all he did was sell two helicopters through a law firm in San Antonio to a client who just happened to be in the Zetas, and then later buy one of the helicopters and its logbook back. Reed added that TR had once fired a blank round at a business partner's head to threaten him. "Couldn't have happened that way, as I always keep around in the chamber," TR countered later. And, of course, TR was a skilled pilot. "His most extreme flight risk I've ever seen," Reed concluded. TR pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit arson and conspiracy to commit wire fraud and was sentenced to 65 months in a low-security federal prison in Big Spring. He was also ordered to forfeit his Learjet and to pay $988,554.83 in restitution to various insurance companies. $70,000 confiscated from him in Las Vegas was applied to that restitution. His associates, including Fosdick, Gordon, and DeLima, pleaded guilty shortly thereafter. Arduin was eventually deported. Today, in his cell, TR is counting down the days until his release, set for February 2022. He hopes for an early release for good behavior, and he fantasizes about his first weekend out when he hopes to dine at Ferraro's Italian restaurant in Las Vegas. To pass the time, he began helping other inmates pursue their GEDs, and he's taking college correspondence courses, the path of least resistance toward a business administration PhD. I simply thought, if someone is going to call me a con man or say, you're an asshole, well, it will be Dr. Asshole, he said. TR reflects occasionally on his crimes, but he doesn't blame Gordon, DeLima, or even Arduin for giving investigators information. He reserves most of his resentment for Fosdick, who, he says, sang like a canary and ruined him. Not only did he lose his assets, but his family. A few years into TR's sentence, Holston sent a note asking him not to contact her anymore. TR was devastated. I miss her terribly, he said. But what seems to irk him the most is the narrative behind his indictment. He rejects the government's portrayal of him as a fraudster focused on petty crime. International arms dealing had become his identity. Trashing a few vehicles barely gave him pause. The boat in Hawaii was an insurance scam he carried out for money, he admits. He had alternative explanations for the other incidents. The Gulf ditching was a way to promote the waterproof case that protected his iPad in the water, made by a company where a friend worked. TR's friend denied this and said he didn't know TR at the time. The Athens fire was a favor for another friend, and the Lamborghini, he said, was an honest crash. Yes, I had around $35 million in fraudulent insurance claims around the world, he wrote me, slipping into characteristic grandiosity, but I never did that for the money. It was almost always for another reason. Simply the excitement of ditching a plane or parachuting out of one at night along a beach to let it crash on its own in the middle of the Atlantic. Maybe, he said, it was a little bit about the money. His stunts may sound implausible to some, he acknowledges, but that was the point. To will into his existence something that sounds so outrageous that people would describe it as unbelievable. That was the fun of it the whole time. The joy of being able to tell stories that demanded his audience's attention, making them wonder if their lives were maybe a little gray in comparison. Some days, when he's reminiscing in his cell, he tries to look on the bright side. If he hadn't gotten caught when he did, his business only would have escalated towards riskier, more dangerous, illegal dealings. I probably would have had a RICO, or racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations indictment. I probably would have been offered 20 years, gone to trial, and gotten life, he said. So part of me says, yeah, I got screwed in getting 5 years for petty little insurance fraud. But at the same time, you know, maybe it's the best thing that could have happened to me. Worst case, it would make a good chapter in his book. Next, we're going to flip over to the Willie Nelson Special Edition magazine that came with this September issue. And this article we're going to finish up today is the 10 best albums that Willie Nelson ever put out. Over the course of his more than six decades as a recording artist, Willie Nelson has released 143 legitimate albums, not counting compilations or a near infinite number of repackagings. Here, as determined by a committee of diehard fans and experts, are the greatest, and we are starting today with number three on the way to two and one, since we've already read 10 through four, and his third best album ever, Stardust, on Columbia Records in 1978, with more than 5 million copies sold. Stardust did by far Willie's best-selling album, first Willie record many fans owned, and wrong-headed as this will sound, in some cases the only one. Featuring his take on top 10 pop standards, it can rightly be categorized as easy listening, which is no knock. It is, in fact, undeniably easy to listen to, because whatever else one might say about it, Stardust is a beautiful record. Like all that, people forget that it's the most radical move Willie ever made. One thing, Columbia was dead set opposed. Outlaw country lit the world on fire, and execs wanted more of that, not a bunch of songs from the 20s. Rick Blackburn, the label's marketing head, told Willie, do a Luckenbach, Texas, or some damn thing. Stay with the mood that's hot. Willie stood his ground, and because his contract gave him creative control, he won. But that was only the start of the weirdness. Willie tapped soul legend Booker T. Jones, his upstairs neighbor in a Malibu condo complex, to produce. They recorded in 1 week at Emmylou Harris's house in L.A. with the band set up in her living room, save for Mickey Raphael, who recorded his harmonica in her bathroom. The tile gave a great reverb. And then Willie refused to put his photo on the cover, a no-no in Nashville, opting for a moody painting of the night sky by Guy Clark's wife, Susanna. Then he turned in a perfect record, impossibly delicate, each melody caressed, each word almost whispered. Hoagy Carmichael's Stardust opens, and as Frank Sinatra and Tommy Dorsey did on the 40s version he'd heard as a kid, Willie drops the opening verse, picking a brief trigger meditation on the chords before sliding into the lyrics. Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song. The pace is glacial. Willie's vocal seems to lie farther behind the beat than usual, and gentle anticipation builds in the wait for him, always with a hushed reward. My stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain, the languid tone is set. On Moonlight in Vermont, he keeps the playing out of the way of the lyrics, which Willie likes to point out never rhyme. They're a free verse. He reclaims Unchained Melody from the Righteous Brothers, replacing the drama of their 1965 hit with a sense of mystery. Album tempo kicks upward occasionally, but only slightly. On songs like All of Me and Don't Get Around Much Anymore, Willie's not swinging, but swaying, leaving space for the song's own brilliance to sink in. That stillness, the way it resonates with people who thought they didn't even like Willie Nelson, makes Stardust country music's kind of blue. Out to number two, second best album ever by Willie Nelson, Red-Headed Stranger, Columbia, 1975. Heading home to Texas from a Colorado ski trip, Willie and then-wife Connie began kicking around ideas for a next album. She thought of Red-Headed Stranger, a ballad he often sang to their kids as a lullaby, and asked if he could build a record around that. Later in the drive, as they neared Denver at night, the city lights inspired a new song that Willie thought could advance the Stranger storyline. With three concept albums under his belt, Willie was formulating a fourth. By the time they arrived back home, the idea was percolating at full tilt. Willie mapped out a tale of an Old West preacher who kills his philandering wife and her lover before riding off, haunted and alone, eventually finding peace and redemption. He'd relate the plot through vintage songs such as Scotty Wiseman's Remember Me and Fred Rose's Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain. New Willie originals like Time of the Preacher and Denver would unify it into a cohesive dramatic narrative. Willie decided to record old school, live in a studio, backed by the same musicians he toured with. Simplicity ruled. He forbade any of the technical sweetening Nashville producers routinely added to vocals. The result was a minimalist Western noir, film noir of stark and jarring clarity. Total expense, $4,000, a fraction of the production cost of any Nashville album. Columbia had no issues with the money. It was the music that set them off. Label president Bruce Lundvall likened the unvarnished tracks to a demo. Billy Sherrill, who headed Columbia's Nashville operations, wanted to smooth out the sound. Willie's contract, however, was unambiguous. They were bound to release what he gave them, as is. Label expected the record to bomb, but to the executive's amazement, Red-Headed Stranger was embraced by country and rock audiences. The album reached number one in the country charts. The first single, Blue Eyes, did the same, and then the second, Remember Me, went to number two. The album even cracked the top 30 in the overall Billboard 200. At 42, after more than a decade of frustration, Willie Nelson was country's hottest star. And lastly, but not leastly, Willie's number one album ever, Phases and Stages, on Atlantic Records from 1974. By 1974, rock acts had already embraced the concept album and done it to death, but country LPs were still pretty much what albums had been originally, a second chance to sell a single or two with a lot of filler sandwiched between. Willie was the exception. His 1971 song cycle, Yesterday's Wine, was a fully realized parable of faith, and with Phases and Stages, he hit the sweet spot, crafting a concept album about the end of a marriage. The structure itself was novel. Side one of the original LP was Willie singing from a woman's point of view, side two from the man's. And unlike Red-Headed Stranger, the concept album that followed Phases and made him a star, every song on Phases was written by Willie. The songwriter tells a story in his own words. Making it was a messy proposition. Story producer Jerry Wexler had shown Willie the possibilities of recording outside the Nashville bubble with their first collaboration, 1973's Shotgun Willie. For the second album, Wexler wanted him to work with the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, the then little-known group of Alabama white guys who provided the groove on classic recordings by Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett. Nashville, Wexler brought in A-teamers to ensure country sound, and Willie brought the songs. They recorded in Willie time, 2 days in and out, but he picked enough nits with Wexler's choices that many tracks were reworked at Nugget Studios near Nashville out of Wexler's purview. Final mix was completed at Wexler's favorite new studio, Criteria, in Miami. Somehow, this odd mix of players and locales worked, resulting in a country album that sounded like no country album that preceded it. Side one is the wife's take, opening with her washing the dishes, scrubbing the floors, caring for someone who don't care anymore. A sigh of resignation amid the drudgery is palpable. From there, the song titles themselves practically tell the story. She sifts through her anger in Pretend I Never Happened, returns to her family on Sisters Coming Home, and tries to get her old life back in Down at the Corner Beer Joint. Then, finally in How Will I Know, I'm Falling in Love Again, with Willie at a whisper, the hesitant woman finds the strength to move on. Willie then turns to the husband, who has a harder time expressing himself. It's easier to just let her rip, which is what happens on Bloody Mary Morning, a high-flying testimonial to self-medication. Reality hits like a gut punch on I Still Can't Believe You're Gone, which may be the saddest country song ever written, but then the narrator's back in denial, voicing disbelief in It's Not Supposed to Be That Way. After spinning his wheels on heaven and hell, he leaves off with the existential shrug of pick up the tempo. It is what it is, you know. Might as well take it on home. Released in March 1974, the album reached number 34 on Billboard's Country Albums chart, while only one of its three singles, Bloody Mary Morning, broke into the top 20, peaking at number 17. That September, Atlantic Records folded its Nashville subsidiary, ending its great country music experiment, and Willie moved on to Columbia, Stranger, and Stardom. What's left is a masterpiece. You want to understand why some of us consider this Willie guy our North Star? Sit through this one. Pay attention to what's sung and said, or as Willie might put it, carefully consider the whole situation. Somehow he takes us inside two people's heads to tell a story that anyone who has ever shared a bed with another person, that is, pretty much all of us, can relate to, learn from, or at least find a little solace in. It's Willie at his most universal and absolutely singular best. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of our reading for today.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
Need help? Know someone who does? If you or someone you care about are feeling overwhelmed with emotions like sadness, depression, or anxiety, or you feel like you want to harm yourself or others, call 911. Call the Disaster Distress Helpline at 800-985-5900 or call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233.
As we live through one of the country's most severe economic downturns, we strive to bring you information about money, investing, consumer news, and the energy industry. Mondays at 6 a.m., it's the Kiplinger's newsletter and Money Matters. Tuesdays at 6 a.m., The Economist. Wednesdays at 6 a.m., a weekly roundup of the Lone Star State with News of Texas. Thursdays at 6 a.m., Consumer Reports. And Fridays at 6 a.m., Permian Basin Oil and Business News from the Midland Report. Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Weekday mornings at 6 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
I loved, and I knew I had to. Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 102 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 60s. Then, tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the September issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with Rolling with the Wheel, Western Swing Disciples Asleep at the Wheel, Mark 50 Years and Countless Miles of Texas by Joe Nick Potoski. One afternoon this March, the visage of Ray Benson, founder and leader of the band Asleep at the Wheel, flickered before my eyes. Well, on my computer screen, actually, courtesy of FaceTime. It had been a rough 2 weeks. Plans for a 50th anniversary Asleep at the Wheel reunion show and recording session in the band's hometown of Austin had been done in by the coronavirus. Without his trademark cowboy hat, Benson looked downright deflated. He said as much. It wasn't the thwarted album or the cancellation of his annual birthday party show in March. It was the stage being ripped from his soul. "I haven't gone this long without playing in front of an audience since I was 18," Benson moaned. As it turned out, Benson had plenty reason to be bummed. A few days after our conversation, he was in the news, having tested positive for COVID-19. Thankfully, the 69-year-old recuperated, and a few weeks later, we talked again. "Well, I've got time," a revitalized Benson boomed through the computer screen. He'd just wrapped up an online board meeting of the nonprofit Texas Cultural Trust, but it wasn't like he had a gig to rush off to. In a weird way, it was telling that Benson was among the first high-profile Texans diagnosed with COVID-19. His familiar baritone sounds like Texas, just like the Western swing band he's led for 50 years sounds like Texas. If there's a dance hall in the Lone Star State, with a stage and a dance floor that'll hold enough folks, Asleep at the Wheel has played it. With fiddles and steel, the Wheel has articulated an ensemble sound that links Western swing, the made-in-Texas original sound, popularized by Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys in the 1930s and 40s, with modern Western sounds. Asleep at the Wheel have kept Western swing vital and relevant to country music and gave it a worldwide audience, said Rich Kinzel, a country music historian. Asleep at the Wheel's been playing so well for so long, it's actually eclipsed Wills' band in longevity. Along the way, Benson and his crew have graced thousands of stages, released more than 25 albums, won 10 Grammy Awards, and counted nearly 100 musicians among its membership. "I wanted more broken spokes, more Cotton Eye Joes, more Western swing music," Benson said, looking back across a half-century of nurturing Western swing's flame. Guess what? It happened. There are a number of Western swing bands around the country now. Pretty good for an idea hatched by two boys from the suburbs of Philadelphia. The story begins in the 1950s, when Ray Benson Seifert and Reuben Gosfeld, who later adopted the showbiz names Ray Benson and Lucky Oceans, started running together at age 3, going to the same schools and summer camp, buying records, seeing shows, and playing in bands. A Gene Autry show in Philadelphia was a transformative moment for both of them. Ocean's eyes popped when he saw Autry ride his horse onto the theater stage. After getting deep into Hank Williams in 1969, Benson made a proposal. "We're going to be the first hippies to have a real country western band." Leroy Preston met Benson and Oceans in Boston in 1969. He was a Vermont farm kid with a guitar, raised on country music and rock and roll. The three decided to start a band, and in the spring of 1970, they took a break from college and moved to a friend's farm near Pawpaw, West Virginia. Joining them was Danny Levin, a pianist and fiddler from Boston. For months, it was bunky cabin living, bonding, and building the musical base for the band, Preston said. "We were broke," Benson recalled. "Lucky's folks, in their wisdom, gave us a 100-pound sack of flour, a 100-pound sack of oats, and a tub of peanut butter, and said, 'Don't starve.' Friends of ours brought us deer meat. We were very serious that the band was our job." One night at a nearby club, Ernest Tubb and his Texas Troubadours left an impression. "They were blowing jazz in the warm-up set, just smoking," Preston said. "And then Ernst came out, and as straight as TikTok, they were on classic country. It was the aha moment for us. You can do both." On August 25, 1970, Asleep at the Wheel played their first gig, opening for Hot Tuna and Alice Cooper in Washington, D.C. The Wheel played country standards, Cocaine Blues, and Truck Driving Man, as straight as a band could be with a long-haired, barefoot guitarist standing 6'7". One young singer, Chris O'Connell, was so enthralled seeing The Wheel open for the country rock outfit Poco at American University, she followed the band back to Pawpaw and became its female vocalist. "All of a sudden, we had a big band that was really good," Benson said. The band took off for East Oakland, California, in 1971, and immediately gained a following, sharing a manager in club dates with Commodore Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen, and bills with the Doobie Brothers, Tower of Power, and Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks. Soon, a young jazz-trained pianist from Berkeley hired on after a one-song audition. He then changed his name from Jim Haber to Floyd Domino. With an opportunity to back up mainstream country acts, the hippie country outfit got serious, cutting their hair and donning western suits to play with the likes of Stoney Edwards, a black honky-tonk singer on Capitol Records. Around that time, the band went to Nashville to record its first album. "We wanted to be a country band," Preston said. "We didn't want to be lumped with New Riders of the Purple Sage or the Flying Burrito Brothers." Their first album, Comin' Right At Ya, was produced by Tommy Alsup, the Texan who had played in Bob Wills' Texas Playboys, and as one of Buddy Holly's crickets. Alsup brought in fiddler Johnny Gimble, another Playboys alumnus. The Wheels' version of Take Me Back to Tulsa became the star of their reinvention of Western swing and got the band touring in Texas. "The audience in Texas knew our music as roots rather than fad," Preston said. Up until then, Wills' music had been only a small part of the band's repertoire. But The Wheel added twin fiddlers in California, and in 1973, Benson and the band saw Wills at a Dallas studio during the recording of the Texas Playboys album For the Last Time. A formal introduction planned for the next day didn't happen. Wills had a stroke that night and never recovered. The Wheel played venues like the Farmer's Daughter in San Antonio, the Western Place in Dallas, where Willie Nelson showed up to introduce himself and jam with the band on stage, and the Armadillo World Headquarters in Austin, where they opened for Commodore Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen. "It was like, holy moly, this is heaven," Benson said of the crowd's untethered enthusiasm. The band moved to Austin in February 1973 at the urging of Nelson and Doug Somm. It was an exciting time, when long hairs and cowboy hats were suddenly a thing.